Hi, and welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, David Gottlieb. My guest today is Moti Inbari, Associate Professor of Religion at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. Professor Inbari is a scholar of Jewish fundamentalism, and he joins me today to discuss his most recent book, Jewish Radical Ultra-Orthodoxy Confronts Modernity, Zionism, and Women's Equality, published by Cambridge University Press in 2016. In his book, Professor Inbari delves into correspondence and recently obtained archival materials to detail the decisive influence on ultra-Orthodox life of prominent 20th century leaders. The most prominent are Rabbi Amram Blau, founder of the anti-Zionist Nature Karta movement, and Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, who was head of the Satmar Hasidic sect in New York. Professor Inbari concludes with an analysis of contemporary trends in radical ultra-Orthodoxy and a comparison between those trends and messianic religious Zionism and religious zealotry during the Second Temple period. Professor Inbari documents the ultra-Orthodox encounter with modernity, which continues to become more nuanced and complex, even as ultra-Orthodox leaders become more insistent and extreme in their attempts to resist change. Professor Inbari, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background, your academic background, and how you became interested in the subject of Jewish ultra-Orthodoxy?
Okay, I was born and raised in Jerusalem into a secular family, not an Orthodox family. And as someone who was living in Jerusalem, you cannot ignore the strong influence of Orthodoxy on the city's population. And I was just interested in learning more about Orthodox, and the current research that we are going to talk about today is actually my third book. My first and second books were on religious Zionism, and which is another Orthodox movement that supports the state of Israel. It's like ultra-Zionist movement. And the current research is kind of expanding my investigation into Orthodoxy and different aspects of Orthodoxy, now with ultra-Orthodoxy. The way in which I found myself studying this research was actually by kind of a coincidence. I was a postdoctoral fellow at Brandeis University between 2007 and 2009, and during that period, Boston University has acquired Rabbi Blau, the founder of Nature Karta. Boston University has acquired his personal archive. As someone who is interested in Orthodoxy, and I was writing my research on religious Zionism, I was interested in go to that archive and to see what they found, and this is how my research has started, going over this personal archive and studying Nature Karta, and it's from the inside, you know, from the kishkes of this personal correspondence. I was able to construct two chapters, and after I wrote these two chapters, I figured that I might as well expand it into a whole book.
Detail for us how Boston University came into possession of that? Because as you point out, I think in the book, these are very closed communities that don't often let their innermost kishkis, as you say, be viewed by the secular world. How did Boston University get this material?
Yes. So there is the long and the short answer. The short answer would be through Elie Wiesel's connections.
But
the long answer is even more interesting.
Okay.
So it all comes to Elie Wiesel. You know, Elie Wiesel himself was born into a Hasidic community in Hungary, which was kind of like the one that I've studied in this book. But this was not his old connections that brought him this archive, but the new connections. He actually had a student, a doctoral student, that he was advising, and the father of this doctoral student has obtained this archive from Amram Blau's second wife. So Amram Blau, the founder of Nature Karta, was remarried after his first wife died. And he married a very famous convert by the name of Ruth Ben David.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big dispute between his children from his first wife and the second wife. The children didn't like the second wife. and didn't want her father to get married with her. So after he died, she didn't want his children to obtain, you know, his letters and so on. So she hid them with the father of that doctoral student. And after that father died, the children went to the attic and found this archive and didn't know what to do with it. So since he was studying at Boston University, he said, well, I might as well donate it to Boston University. So this is how it...
That's a very circuitous and interesting story, and I hope we'll talk about Ruth Ben-David later on in this interview. But I wonder if you could, for those of our listeners who may not know much about ultra-Orthodoxy, what is it exactly? How would you define it, and what differentiates it from Zionist Orthodoxy or modern Orthodoxy, just for two examples?
Yes, sure. Yes. So ultra-Orthodox Jews would argue that they are the holders of pure Judaism. This is how Judaism used to be before the age of change, the 19th century and modernity. But of course, this is much more complex than that. So once new possibilities of Jewish identities have emerged in Europe during the 19th century years with Haskalah or Reform Judaism and later Bund or Zionism, those who want to remain loyal to tradition and to stay observant have decided to create some kind of barrier between themselves and the rest of the Jewish community. And so this is where they reemerged. That recreated the Jewish ghetto. And so during the modern period, the Jewish ghetto no longer existed. Jews were allowed to leave the ghetto and be part of societies in which they've lived in. But Orthodox Jews decided to remain in some kind of an enclave, a ghetto, where they will be protected from the influences of the modern world, and this is how ultra-Orthodoxy has emerged. And the location at which it has emerged was in Hungary, in Poland, and in Russia. Now, difference between the movements is within the attitude toward different aspects of change. So modern Orthodoxy, or it used to be called Neo-Orthodoxy, was the type of Orthodoxy that was active in Germany. So in Neo-Orthodoxy, later turned into modern Orthodoxy, there was this openness for secular education. So you can still the motto was you can still be an Orthodox Jew and be an educated Jew, be a lawyer, be a physician, be all kinds of modern professions. Ultra-Orthodoxy was much more suspicious toward these educational changes. And religious Zionism or Zionist Orthodoxy has argued a similar argument that you can still be an Orthodox and to accept the Jewish national movement and be part of the Jewish national movement, the Zionist movement. Ultra-Orthodoxy on its behalf was much more suspicious towards Zionism, and eventually it made Zionism to be one of its biggest enemies.
Interesting. So what are the textual bases for ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionism?
Okay, so anti-Zionist ultra-Orthodoxy is based on several reasons. First, they didn't like the secular nature of the Zionist pioneer. Mm-hmm. Of course, they are Orthodox, and they want people to remain loyal to traditions and religious laws, and the Zionist was secular and even anti-religious, so this is one level of hostility. But on another level, there is much deeper issue here, which is that according to the way in which Jews understood the messianic area or what would happen when the Messiah would come, there was an expectation that God will send from heaven a Messiah that would perform miracles and will take the Jews from their exile back into their ancient land to reestablish the ancient Jewish monarchy, as it's written in our sacred text. So when the Zionists came and said, we want to immigrate to Palestine and we want to establish a Jewish state for the Jewish people that would govern by secular laws, it was viewed as a rebellion against God's authority, because the Jewish scriptures have anticipated that all of this would happen through a miracle and not through human actions. And therefore, ultra-Orthodoxy developed this hostility towards Zionism as a rebellion against God, as a disbelief that God can perform miracles and God can redeem the Jews through, you know, through an act that will be beyond nature. Mm-hmm. And this is the source of this opposition.
So if that were the case, it's really interesting because dating back to even the late 19th century, there were Orthodox communities in Palestine and then in British Mandate Palestine. What were relations like between European ultra-Orthodox communities and those in Palestine, especially between the First and Second World Wars?
Yes, so of course, so we are referring here to the old Yeshuv.
Yes.
So there is this belief in Jewish tradition and custom that the land of Israel, yes, as it's referred to, is a holy land. And from the land of Israel, when you pray in the land of Israel, your prayers are heard louder in heaven, and especially in sacred cities like Jerusalem, Safed, Hebron, and so throughout the years, there is a record that there was some kind of a community of Jews living in Palestine for hundreds of years. This was a small community, and the purpose of this community was to be Torah scholars. So they will pray, and they will pray for the sake of the Jewish people as a whole. And since their prayers are conducted from Jerusalem, and since they are so holy in their nature, because all they do is just devote themselves to Torah study, God will listen to their prayers and he will bring redemption for the Jewish people. So this is an old Jewish understanding of what does it mean to live in the land of Israel. And so it has to be for sacred purposes. And the purpose of the diaspora, Jewish diaspora, is to support this community, small community of Torah scholars, and support them financially so they can do it, that they can live their lives there, mm-hmm. devoted only to the study of the Torah. And once the Zionist community was starting to establish, where men and women immigrated to Palestine in order to establish colonies and to be productive and to work the land and to be farmers, this was viewed such an opposition to what Jews throughout generations understood the role of Jews in the Holy Land. Mm-hmm. This was such an opposition to that.
So into this cauldron, which is already politically active and contentious, comes the amazing personality of Amram Blau, who is the founding figure of the Neturei Karta movement. Can you tell us something about him personally, and how his personal style and idiosyncratic, powerful personality influenced the community that he helped to create?
Yeah, so Amram Blau was a zealot by the true meaning of the term. Yeah, so he took everything to the extreme, and he was oppositional to any type of change and any type of compromise. So when he saw the leadership of ultra-Orthodoxy making compromises to any type of moderation or change, even when they didn't really want this change, but it was forced on them, he stood up and he demonstrated against any type of moderation and change. And his zealotry, you know, that he is so genuine to pure ideas and he's never willing to compromise on any type of moderation that is needed, made him a hero. Yes, it's like mm-hmm. a superhero.
Yeah,
like a super. Yes, he is not. You cannot. Make him less pure. Yes, mm-hmm. I can't even find a word for that mm-hmm. at this point. Yes, but he's a pure zealot.
Yeah.
No one, a person that never is willing to compromise.
Okay. And how did this influence the community? In fact, how did he even manage to build a community given the extremity of his personality, the confrontational nature with which he approached conflict? How did a community form around him?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting society's dynamic. dynamics. Because the community, the ultra-Orthodox community, realized that they are a small minority inside Israel or Palestine, mandatory Palestine, the Jewish mandatory Palestine, and they cannot impose their worldview on the greater society. So they wanted to just, so they realized that they need to make some compromises in their lifestyle, and what they're looking best is just to try to segregate themselves from the rest of the society.
Mm-hmm.
But they realized that this is compromise, and this is not the perfect ideal way of life. And when Amram Bloy came and started demonstrating, and his first big demonstrations were against modesty, that Jewish women were becoming less modest in his eyes. And so the ultra-Orthodox, and later on, the ultra-Orthodox society was reluctant to follow him because, you know, in their view, he was right. Yes, a Jewish woman should be modest in their view. And in their view, Jews should not walk on the Sabbath, and Jews should not drive their cars on the Sabbath, and Jews should not play soccer on Sabbath, and Jews should not go to swimming pools, men and women together.
Mm-hmm.
So he was taking on principal subjects, and he was demonstrating over them. And the ultra-Orthodox community as a whole was not very happy to see him demonstrate, but they agreed that he was right, that the goals that he had selected for himself were correct, and they should be in opposition to them. And therefore, he was able to obtain this status that he's not just a crazy radical, you know, zealot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a point behind what he's making. And so, therefore, at least they need to support him through silence and, you know, through silent support.
So, and one other thing that's clear from your work is that part of the, perhaps the main aspect that influences the extremity of this view is that the ultra-Orthodox community plays a critical role in the onset of the Messianic era. And one theme of your work is the influence of Messianism on ultra-Orthodox political and cultural orientation. And I know it's a massive topic, but can you just shed some light for us on how the ultra-Orthodox view the relationship between their practices and the hoped-for advent of the Messianic era?
Yes, so this is a very good point, and I think this is one of the big discoveries of my research. So until recently, scholars have viewed religious Zionism as the holder of the Messianic position,
mm-hmm.
that by joining the Zionist movement, they would help bring about the advent of the Messianic era through the reconstruction of the Jewish kingdom as the Jewish monarchy as it used to be in ancient times. And these steps would bring about into a fulfillment that God will complete the job that mankind is doing through the Zionist enterprise.
Right.
And ultra-Orthodoxy basically have offered a mirror image to religious Zionism. And so there are two major models.
Uh-huh.
There are two major models to how would the Messiah come at the end of days. So the most common model, which I referred to earlier, is that God will send a righteous Messiah through an act of miracles. And this is the one that I refer to as the apocalyptical messianism. So all that mankind needs to do in that regard is to be righteous and to observe the religious laws and to be holy. And when God would see that people are so holy, he will send the righteous Messiah from heaven, and this is how the end of days would come to be.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one model. The second model is based on Maimonides, that that gives some leverage for mankind to take some action in order to bring the Messiah. And there are all kinds of interpretations of Maimonides' ideas, but religious Zionists basically adopted the argument that that the messianic age can be achieved through human action, by taking possession of the ancient land and establishing a kingdom and reestablishing a temple in Jerusalem. And this would bring about the messianic age.
Okay.
So ultra-Orthodoxy responded to religious Zionism by arguing that this is false messianism. And if you truly want to bring the Messiah, what you really need to do is to immerse yourself in Torah study. And this is the best security for gaining a true messianic fulfillment, rather than, you know, taking actions by human that can be faulty, that can make mistakes. So if you want a perfect messianic area, you should be just in engaged in Torah study and in opposition to Zionism, which was viewed as false messianism. So yes, this subgroup that I have studied, the radical ultra-Orthodox, basically was also highly engaged in messianic expectations. They really believe that this is something that's going to take place soon. And the way for them to make it happen was to be extreme, to take everything to the extreme, just to be sure that you're righteous enough. So their righteousness was to the extreme. No moderation, no compromises, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And this would be the best guarantee that the Messiah would really come.
There appears to be an inherent conflict between apocalyptic and, I guess, what you would call maybe eschatological messianism. One believes, or Zionist, you know, ultra-Orthodox Zionist messianism, one being that human activity can only interfere with the advent of the Messiah, and the other believing that human activity is essential to it. Were there and do there continue to be conflicts between these two sort of orientations?
Yeah, this is an ideological debate that reflects on actions. Yes, so the religious Zionist argument that actions can bring the Messiah would be translated into settlements, into supporting right-wing politics in Israel.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Whereas the ultra-Orthodox response to this would be that anti-Zionism and anti-politics would be the path to bring the Messiah.
So that explains then why the Neturei Karta movement took the extraordinary step of sending a delegation to Iran to join in an anti-Zionist, anti-Israel conference. That gained a great deal of attention when it happened. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. This is an ongoing argument that ultra-Orthodoxy is making, that Zionism is not advancing the coming of the Messiah, just the contrary. It pushes it back, and it makes the journey even longer. So if you want to see Messiah walking on earth in your lifetime, what you need to do is to be an anti-Zionist, and to make the state of Israel disappear, dismantle. This would be the true path to bring righteous Messiah to earth. So they've been doing this for a long period of time, they're opposing Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But the most radical, I think, example was what, as you said, when they sent a delegation to Tehran to embrace, you know, Holocaust deniers, and this was a really surreal view.
Yeah, amazing, considering some of their leadership and many of their communities had perished in the Holocaust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Holocaust denials of all things.
Yeah, amazing. So that brings me to one of the other prominent figures in the book, and that is Yoel Teitelbaum, who became leader of the Satmar Hasidic sect and who established a large and still prominent community that began in New York City and purchased land outside of New York City, which is now known as Kiryat Yoel. What makes Yoel Teitelbaum such an important figure in the ultra-Orthodox world?
So we can say several things. First of all, he was able to reestablish from nothing, from zero, the Hasidic community, the Hungarian Hasidic community, and to establish it in New York City, And this is a very big Hasidic movement. It's one of the largest, maybe some say it is the largest Hasidic movement that exists today. So just in terms of size and influence, it has become a very important Hasidic movement. And when he came to New York, he couldn't find even 10 men to pray with him in the synagogue. There were no Hasidic Jews living in the United States at that point after the Holocaust. So this is one achievement that he has achieved. It's really an amazing achievement to revive to the Hasidic world after the Holocaust. So this is one thing that makes him an important figure. But another is that he was the leader of the anti-Zionist movement within ultra-Orthodoxy. And the logic that he has established in his books, why ultra-Orthodoxy should not support Israel and should not just not be supportive, but to be anti, in opposition to Israel, has become the logic of ultra-Orthodoxy altogether. So ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel and other places, they can, you know, live in peace with the state of Israel. Some of them are even participating in Israeli politics and so on. But on the level of principle, they all oppose Zionism because they accepted the logic of Yoel Teitelbaum. And so this is why he is an important figure.
You describe his personality vividly, too, I would like to just ask you about that, because the personalities of these leaders are so decisive in some respects in terms of how their movements develop. And one aspect of Teitelbaum's personality that you describe is what seems to be an obsessive compulsive disorder that manifests itself in his extreme quest for personal purity. And you relate this to his hesitancy to settle in Jerusalem. Can you explain this and help us understand how this aspect of his personality informed his leadership style and enhanced his influence?
You know, this is a very complicated story to tell, but as you have mentioned, the testimonies about him show that he always felt like he's not good enough, that he's not pure enough. And in the psychology of his personality, I try to see how these feelings of not being a perfect person, not being pure enough, have influenced his decisions throughout his life. And one of the important decisions that he has made as a Holocaust survivor was where to resettle. And his first decision was to move to Jerusalem. And it made a lot of sense. You know, it was 1946, and he was in Switzerland, and he had to make a decision. And he decided to move to Jerusalem because Jerusalem already contained a Hasidic life, the Hasidic courts, and it's ultra-Orthodox city. And it seems most perfect that a person like him would join that community and would establish himself in that community. And so he did, and he moved to Jerusalem, but he became very sick during that period that he lived in Jerusalem, a life-threatening sickness. And after he was able to recuperate from his sickness, he basically packed his bags and left Jerusalem for good, never to return to it. And I think the way he interpreted his sickness was that God is punishing him. And he was trying to figure out what was the wrongdoing that he has made that brought him his sickness. And the conclusion that he has reached that he is not pure enough to live in such a holy city like Jerusalem. So he cannot be a part of it. So basically once he became well again, he just packed his bags and moved as far as he could, and the destination was your city.
And this is so interesting because he narrowly escaped death during the Holocaust. In fact, he was even interned briefly at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. And it seems from the documentation that you have presented in the book that he had to make some kind of accommodation to the Zionist movement in order to effect his escape. How did that experience influence him?
Yes, I think this is the key to understand his sense of being impure. So this is, again, a very tragic story of Hungarian Jewry and the Kastner train affair. Mm-hmm. So when Germany occupied Hungary in 1944, Germany was already losing the war on the Russian front. And Germany tried to find more resources for its war efforts, and an idea came up to Adolf Eichmann, to try to blackmail the Jewish community to finance their war effort. And in that regard, he was willing to make a deal with the Jewish community in Hungary to save the Jewish community in return for money. And so to test this deal, Eichmann was willing to allow 1,600 Jews to get on a train from Budapest to Switzerland, to a neutral place. Actually, the destination was Lisbon, but eventually the train ended up in Switzerland. But this was not as simple as it sounds. First, the destination of the train was actually Auschwitz, and then they changed the destination to Bergen-Belsen instead. And after that, the passengers were sent to Switzerland. And in each destination and each location, Eichmann demanded more and more money, was blackmailing the Jewish community. And the Jews knew that they're not sure that they can trust Eichmann. So when the first train, so it was the plan was that there would be multiple trains that will eventually leave Budapest to a safe location. And this was a test case to see if it can happen. And so Rudolf Kastner, who was the head of the Jewish community in Budapest, came up with a list of 1,600 people that would go on that train. This was a very controversial story. A lot of people on this train were his family members and friends, and many of the Zionist leadership of Hungary. And also Rabbi Teitelbaum was on the train. He, his wife, and his personal assistant, 3 seats on the train. Mm. And I came to ask myself, how come Kastner put Teitelbaum on the train? What's the reason behind it? Because Teitelbaum was an anti-Zionist. Why should he support him? Secondly, why would Teitelbaum take a seat on the train that is led by the Zionist leadership of Budapest? And the conclusions that I have reached through the clues and through the information that I found was that there was probably a deal that was made between Teitelbaum and Kastner's father-in-law, in which Teitelbaum promised that he will not oppose the Zionist movement, and in return, he would get a seat on the train. And I think this is where he felt impure, and this is why I felt when he came to Jerusalem, he decided to leave after a short while, after he was sick, because he knew he had made a compromise, like he has made a bargain with the Satan, yes?
Right,
so,
right.
So, yeah. And now this is why God punished him with his sickness. So there's this story that is standing behind his decisions to get to New York rather than Jerusalem. And, you know, this compromise, they tried to hide it. They tried to not to make it public. And I think, but you can't ignore all the evidence that is available there. And putting the pieces together got me into this conclusion that this was probably the case.
Yeah. So interesting. And you conclude, as I pointed out at the beginning, you conclude your book with an analysis of contemporary trends in radical ultra-Orthodoxy. What are the current trends that are impacting these communities? What are they focused on now? And what is the state of their demographics? Are they growing? Are they shrinking? Are they diversifying? What are they like now, and what are their priorities?
You know, again, it's very complex. So after Rabbi Teitelbaum died, his wife basically created a rebellion in the community and broke the community into two parts. And this is an amazing development, because women in those Hasidic communities are so marginalized.
Yeah.
So Rabbi Teitelbaum, before he died, he had a stroke. And for a period of 8 years, he was not functioning, basically. And so he was still the leader of the Hasidic community, but the way to communicate with him was through his wife. And after he died, the wife did not want to end her role as the person that is in the middle between the rabbi and the community. And she started going up to his grave and communicating with him, you know, through telepathy. So basically she said, you know, there's no need to change anything, because I can communicate with him in heaven. And so he can still be the leader of the community, and I will be the in-between person between
the prophetic voice, as it were.
Yeah. Exactly. So majority of the members of the Hasidic community opposed this solution. But there was a voice inside the community that actually supported it. And the Hasidic Satmar basically broke into two: those who followed the wife and those who followed the new leader that came after him. He was his cousin. And this schism remained after the successor died himself, where his two children took, each one of them took a part of the Satmar community to lead. And so this movement was just splitting and splitting. But some of the interesting things that are taking place in this movement is, besides the leadership disputes, is that this is a movement that is becoming financially weaker and weaker, and relying more and more on welfare.
Yeah.
So to what extent they can go so poor without making any changes, this is something that has to be, you know, addressed. Until what point they can still rely on social security and so on. So this is one major challenge for this community.
Mm-hmm.
Another, in polls that were conducted by the Jewish community of New York, have revealed a very interesting trend among them, that about 30% of all from Satmar who responded to the poll have said that they actually support Israel very much. They were supposed to be anti-Zionist, and suddenly
right.
You see a third of them are supportive of Israel. How can you explain it? And this is hard for me to explain, but I think that there are some underlying movements within this community of people who demand change, who want to see things happening differently. They don't want to be so poor. They don't want to marginalize women so much. They want to take a different path. And one of the ways it is expressed is by actually supporting Israel. It's like a youth rebellion or something that is kind of taking place under the scene.
And part of what has driven change in these communities too, has it not, has been the need for women to get jobs and support the family economically, because the men are studying Torah.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And how long can women be willing to, from one hand, to take all the responsibility of the house on themselves, including going to work and raising 10 or 8 children, from one hand, from the other hand, has no voice, has no say in the society? So I think these trends that they were trying to establish are just now starting to shake. And maybe it's not visible so much now, but eventually it will, I assume it will impact this community.
I wanted to go back before we concluded our interview and talk again about another very influential woman in the ultra-Orthodox world, and that was Amram Bloy's second wife, Ruth Ben-David. Could you tell us a little bit about who she was and how she influenced the Neturei Karta movement?
Okay, so Ruth Ben-David is really an exceptional story. She was born in France as Madeleine Frey, and she was French, she was Catholic, and in the late 1940s, she decided to convert to Judaism as a result of the Holocaust. I think she was really moved by what happened to Jews in Europe during the Holocaust, and as a response to that, she wanted to convert to Judaism. And her process of conversion has taken several steps. She first converted through a Reform conversion, and then later she went to conduct an Orthodox conversion. And after conducting Orthodox conversion, she immigrated to Israel and eventually found herself in Mea Shearim, which is the ultra-Orthodox community of Jerusalem. And during the 1950s, there was a family dispute among ultra-Orthodox Jews. One family in which they immigrated to Israel from the Soviet Union. And there was the grandparents were Braslev Hasidim, but the mother and the father decided to take a more lenient Orthodox lifestyle and join the religious Zionist world. So the mother and the father asked their grandparents to take care of their son, Yosele, for a period of time. And when they asked their son back, the grandfather refused to give their son to the parents because he disapproved of the educational school that the parents have signed up the kid. He wanted the son to be in ultra-Orthodox schools, but the parents wanted him to be in a religious Zionist school. And so he gave the boy, he kidnapped the boy and gave him to Neturei Karta. Neturei Karta hid the boy in Israel for a period of time. The police was on their tail. They were starting to track the boy. So eventually they decided that they didn't want this boy to be smuggled outside of Israel. And they have contacted Ruth and asked her to smuggle the boy outside of Israel because of her background. She was French. She had a French passport. And she was willing to do that. And she took the boy and she smuggled him to Switzerland and then to France. And eventually the boy ended up in New York. After a period of about 2.5 years, Israel's Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion decided to recruit the Mossad to find the boy. And after 4 months of searches, the Mossad was able to connect Ruth Ben-David to the smuggling, to the affair. And they have kidnapped her in France. The Mossad kidnapped Ruth in France. And she confessed and gave the boy to the Mossad. And they found the boy in New York. After 3 years of searches. And so she has made a deal with the Mossad that she will not be persecuted for her actions of kidnapping the boy for returning the boy to his parents. And so when she came back to Israel after the events has ended, she became a very famous person. And Amram Bloy just got widowed. His wife died. And he wanted to marry her.
She was younger than him by a couple of decades, right?
Yes, she was younger than him, and he fell in love with her. And how do I know he fell in love with her? Because I found personal letters that he wrote to her, which were love letters, and they are quoted in the book. And he just fell in love with her, and he wanted to marry her. She was much younger. She was probably a very pretty woman. And so he wanted to marry her. His kids were outraged. Mm-hmm. How can the 70-year-old dad marrying a 40-year-old woman, and she's a convert on top of everything? Mm-hmm. And they tried to foil the not to make it happen. And they went to the Supreme Court of the ultra-Orthodox community in Jerusalem and that, quote, made a ruling prohibiting him to marry her, but he was in love. So he decided to marry her anyway. The price was his excommunication, and this is a true love story.
Amazing. Amazing. So my final question for you is, what will your upcoming work focus on? Will you continue to study ultra-Orthodox religion in diaspora and in Israel, or will you turn your attention elsewhere?
So I'm working on several projects, but I can say that I want to expand the research on Ruth Ben David and to develop it into a manuscript that will stand by itself. I found a lot of resources on her at the archive in Boston, including an unpublished autobiography. And this is one of the projects that I'm intending to take in the near future. And there's another book that I'm working on, which it takes me to a different place, which is the study of ideological change. I am I've selected six different figures, modern Jewish leaders, who have made a radical change into their ideology in the 20th century, and I'm going through a very clear, very deep analysis of what brought them to change, and for that purpose I use psychological theories of what bring people to convert their religion. So in that regard, I'm comparing ideological change to conversion, and show that this is actually a very similar process.
Those sound like fascinating works, and I'm hopeful that we'll have a chance to discuss those as well.
Yeah, thanks.
My guest today has been Moti Inbari, Associate Professor of Religion at University of North Carolina at Pembroke, and we've discussed his book, Jewish Radical Ultra-Orthodoxy Confronts Modernity, Zionism, and Women's Equality, published by Cambridge University Press in 2016. Professor Inbari, thank you so much for speaking with me today.